right, thank you very much, Gary. It's a pleasure to be here, of course, as always. And as Gary's going to be telling you about the quantum field theory, roughly speaking, the talk will have two parts. First one will be quite elementary and hopefully introductory, so that we're all on the same page. Although, of course, the selection of topics will be somewhat idiosyncratic, because I've chosen them to prepare you for the second part, which will be slightly more advanced and make contact with more recent developments. So let's start very basic. Some comments on classical mechanics. And intuitively, you might think that you have a visceral understanding of how to count degrees of freedom in classical mechanics. If you have a system of n particles, you might think that, roughly speaking, it should have n degrees of freedom. And here, it's very important that, this notation DOF, it'll appear on almost every slide multiple times, it always stands for degrees of freedom. Okay? We can be more precise about what we mean by counting degrees of freedom in classical mechanics. Namely, the state of a classical system at any fixed time is specified by giving the n position vectors and the n momentum vectors of the particles, and together that data comprises the classical phase space, and at least in three spatial dimensions, that's a 6n dimensional space. So we can say that there's 6n degrees of freedom rather than n, but okay, that's still pretty close to what our intuition told us. And more generally, every classical dynamical system has a phase space, and its dimension is a pretty good notion of what we mean by the number of degrees of freedom. And as you can already see from the description I'm giving, this way of counting degrees of freedom is essentially kinematical. Right? It depends on concepts like phase space, but at no point have I mentioned the Hamiltonian, and so the dynamics doesn't feature prominently in this way of counting. Now, in quantum mechanics, some things are different, but otherwise pretty similar. If you consider a system of n particles in quantum mechanics, we now describe it using a wave function that will depend on, say, n position vectors, n coordinate vectors on the position basis. And so now the wave function has 3n arguments, again staying in standard three-dimensional space. And in fact, the number of arguments of the wave function is the same in any basis you choose for the Hilbert space. So for example, if you Fourier transform and go to the momentum basis, the wave function will still have 3n arguments, and this will always be the same in any basis. And therefore, it's a meaningful and well-defined concept to ask how many arguments does the wave function depend on. For example, we can look at a spin chain, which is rather different than a system of n particles. So if we have a spin chain with n sites, the wave function now also depends on n arguments, but the arguments will be, say, the z projections of the individual spins in the chain. And so these examples kind of give you a sense that counting the number of arguments that the wave function has is a pretty useful way of counting the number of degrees of freedom. And just by the way that these examples pan out, you see that it's pretty similar to the way things worked in classical mechanics. In fact, the correspondence is very sharp, because the number of arguments of the wave function is always half of the dimension of the classical phase space if you are quantizing a system that has a classical kind of progenitor. And there's a good reason for that, but that will not be important for this talk. Okay, so we discussed so far...
Sorry, guys, but the number of arguments is kind of crude, because those arguments, for instance, for spin versus a particle moving on the line, the associated dimension of the Hilbert space could be very different. Is it really appropriate to just count the number of arguments?
Well, so indeed, you might say that another way of counting the number of degrees of freedom, a very different way, would be to look at the dimension of the Hilbert space. So then that would be the analog of the volume of the classical phase space. That's a vastly different notion. For example, as you already implied, that would always be infinite for particles moving in non-compact space, and would be finite for say, a finite spin chain. The type of notion that I'm going after here is more the one that's like the dimension of the classical phase space. Okay. Yeah. But of course, I mean, there's a whole zoo of different measures which all have their merits, and there are others based on more sophisticated topics like entanglement and so forth that we'll get to later. But I'm mostly setting up this very intuitive notion of degree of freedom counting now, so I can tear it down with gusto in a little bit. So
don't take it too seriously now, as you're saying.
So far, we've sort of implied that we're discussing systems of a few particles or a few spins, but of course, most or many interesting systems in nature have zillions of constituents. Here are two pretty nice and kind of tongue-in-cheek examples. Of course, a pot of boiling water has roughly Avogadro's number worth of constituents, and the whole universe has a whole lot more constituents. And so these are typical many-particle systems that we're interested in, many-body systems. And many of you will know, relativistic quantum field theories, like the standard model of elementary particle physics, can and perhaps should also be thought of as examples of such many-body systems with many, many degrees of freedom. Okay. And when we discuss the long-distance behavior of such many-body systems, it's typically much better to describe them using a few smooth functions rather than the many, many individual particle positions. Okay? And passing from that description in terms of the point particles to the description in terms of smooth functions, even classically, involves taking a continuum limit. Okay? So let me walk you a little bit through the picture on the right. The picture on the right is meant to be some sort of discrete lattice approximation to a kind of a one-dimensional string, like say a violin string. So these are point particles that make some shape like this, and at this stage there are n of them, and we can give their x and y coordinates, and maybe there's some notion of a lattice spacing that tells you how far on the string they sit apart. So as we make the lattice spacing finer and make n bigger, add more and more particles, this discrete system will better and better approximate a continuous medium like the string. And in the formal limit, where we take the number of constituents to infinity and the lattice spacing to zero, we get a kind of perfect description in terms of a smooth function where the transverse displacement of the string is a smooth function of the x-coordinate along this direction. So this is what we mean by a continuum limit. This is very standard. This is, for example, how going through such a procedure and applying Newton's laws to the microscopic system here, for example, gives you the derivation of the wave equation for the string. The one important point I want to make, and this point will be coming up over and over throughout the talk, is that as you take the continuum limit, some details about the microscopic system that you started with are washed out. And that's not surprising. For example, if you put some little kink in the particle arrangement here, if one of the particles sticks out a little funny, then as you take the continuum limit, that won't matter very much. That will not affect the continuous distribution that you get at the end. And another classic example that we're familiar with from kind of our early days in physics is that when we talk about fluids, it's much more useful to describe them using a velocity field, which is a smooth function, more or less smooth function of position, rather than trying to keep track of the position of individual molecules. Okay. So as I've already emphasized in the previous slide, the continuum limit involves taking the number n of degrees of freedom to infinity, and therefore that naive notion of degrees of freedom counting that I started with diverges in the continuum limit. And this is one version of what's known as the UV catastrophe, the ultraviolet catastrophe in classical physics. Right? Each degree of freedom contributes, for instance, a constant amount to, say, the specific heat capacity. If we take the string example as a toy model of a solid, each little atom is, roughly speaking, a harmonic oscillator, and by the classical equipartition theorem, each degree of freedom contributes roughly one unit to the specific heat, and so that will diverge in the continuum limit, in the strict continuum limit. And of course, in a real material, the number of atoms or molecules will always be finite, and there's always some type of short distance cutoff implied, so that underlying lattice is physical. On the other hand, there are other kinds of theories that we are very familiar with that are classical continuum theories, like Maxwell's theory of electromagnetism, where the underlying cutoff is far from obvious if you just look at the classical theory. And it is, in fact, possible to kind of define a lattice version of Maxwell's theory that has finite n and regulates the infinity But now you've kind of modified the theory, and all the observables might actually depend on how you did that modification. And in that example, it's not so clear whether the details of the short distance cutoff scheme are physical, like in the solid, or they're just an artifact of how you cut off the divergence. Okay. So in this way of thinking about things where continuum field theories are limits of discrete systems, the quantization is very straightforward, because if you quantize before you take the continuum limit, everything is just ordinary quantum mechanics. So from that point of view, quantum field theory is not all that more complicated than quantum mechanics. But again, if you first have to regularize and go to the discrete system, then just as in the classical theory, all the observables can in principle depend on the cutoff that we used to regularize the continuum limit. And even though I won't go through any of the details of how this is done, quantum field theory provides a consistent framework for how you extract meaningful continuum physics that is largely independent of how you did the UV cutoff procedure. And the intuitive idea behind this, and the intuitive and very physical idea behind this, is that somehow you should just focus on the long distance degrees of freedom that will end up being important in the continuum limit, like these smooth functions that I was talking about, rather than all the short distance degrees of freedom that live near the cutoff. And so this is a very basic instance of a very general idea called scaling, where you somehow separate the different physical degrees of freedom by scaling. You try to sort of go to the long distance limit. And I'll be much more precise about this in a few slides. Now, quantizing Maxwell theory famously removes the UV catastrophe for the heat capacity. That particular observable, that's what Planck did. That was the very beginning of quantum mechanics, and simultaneously, really, the beginning of quantum field theory in one go. And of course, quantizing the Maxwell field also leads to a new elementary particle or excitation, namely the photon, and that's what Einstein added. And the exact details of how the quantized Maxwell theory were only worked out much later, in the 1930s. And it's really the first example of a relativistic, which is to say, a Lorentz invariant quantum field theory. And of course, by now we know many other examples, including the Standard Model of elementary particle physics. And in such relativistic theories, that whose goal is to describe particle physics, the underlying medium or material that I use to motivate the short distance cutoff is not obvious. I mean, you might be tempted to introduce a lattice at intermediate stages of the calculation, but it's not clear why that should be viewed as fundamental. And one useful notion to keep in the back of your head is that in relativistic theories, vacuum itself can often be usefully thought of as the underlying medium. So that's a little bit highbrow. We'll get back to some more concrete stuff. So the basic observables, some of the basic observables that you talk about in continuum quantum field theory, are just expectation values of local quantum fields. In quantum field theory, the quantum fields now have become operators, and you can sensibly ask what their quantum mechanical expectation values look like. And roughly speaking, two-point expectation values like this one probe the propagation of the excitations or the particles described by the field phi. So this represents, roughly speaking, propagation from point x to point y. And three or higher point functions of the field phi probe interactions and scattering between those quanta. So for example, a three-point correlator, roughly speaking, probes the three-point scattering amplitude of these excitations. Same for four and higher points. So, in fact, by looking at these types of correlators for more and more phis, we can extract the full scattering data and the full S matrix for the particle-like excitations that are described by the field phi. Now, instead of looking at correlation functions of more and more phis, there's another useful way of probing the dynamics of the theory and describing these excitations, which is to couple the field phi to a classical background field. So this J of X is a classical function that acts as a source for the quantum field phi. Right? Turning it on creates phi quanta. And then what you can do is you can look at the fully nonlinear response of the phi field to the turning on of that source, So this is the expectation value of the phi operator in the presence of the source J. And that then includes all the correlation functions of the phis without the source. Roughly speaking, the intuition is that the source, you know, by being time and position dependent, can create this phi quantum and these two phi quanta. And so turning on the source is almost the same as adding these quanta by hand. All right. So far everything I've said has been very general. And indeed, quantum field theory describes a huge number of very diverse physical phenomena. So here are some examples that I would just like to briefly go through. So for example, I already discussed the fact that we can extract data about scattering amplitudes from quantum field theory. And in the top left corner here, you have a complicated scattering event at the Large Hadron Collider particle accelerator that discovered the Higgs boson. And this is a complicated mess. But quantum field theory and the Sandor model in particular is very, very good at predicting what this mess looks like. Another great example of what quantum field theory can do is describe theories of electron fractionalization in two-dimensional systems. So here's a cartoon of the Laughlin state in fractional quantum Hall effect. So here, this is supposed to be an electron that fractionalizes into three quasi-particles. Very interesting, rich, strongly interacting many-body system. Up here is the phase diagram of water and heat the water enough, and you go to the special point in the phase diagram for the critical point, then you'll find a nice, interesting quantum field theory that describes the behavior of the fluid in the vicinity of that point. And,
question?
Yes, please.
Is it necessary to invoke quantum mechanics to understand the phase diagram of water?
No, but there's an interesting and exact correspondence between quantum field theories in D dimensions and classical statistical systems in D plus one dimensions. So you can think of the classical statistical mechanics of water in three spatial dimensions as a 2+1 dimensional quantum field theory. And that's the sense in which this describes that phase diagram, or at least the vicinity of that point. Down here we have confinement in QCD in a four-dimensional gauge theory. Right, this is supposed to be an up quark and a down quark that are tethered together by a kind of collimated flux tube that binds them together. So this is a strongly coupled quantum field theory that describes the hadronic world. And the picture here in the middle is pushing my luck a bit, because of course you know that black holes are gravitational objects that are described by gravity, classical and quantum gravity, and in general quantum field theory is not sufficient to describe their properties, not by a long shot, but there are special kind of lucky or favorable situations in which some properties of black holes can be analyzed by mapping the problem that you ask on the black hole side to a different but equivalent problem in a quantum field theory. So I'll very briefly comment on that later. And so these examples really show to what extent QFT is a unified language that describes many, many areas of physics. One very important concept that will feature throughout the second half of the talk is that of a renormalization group flow. And we've already encountered the intuitive idea that we should disentangle the degrees of freedom at long and short distances. And this is really what the renormalization group, or RG, does for you. It organizes the dynamics of the entire theory by scale. And this is a hugely powerful idea that is usually associated with the name of Ken Wilson, although many, many people make contributions to that. And from now on, I will kind of implicitly be using the terminology that is appropriate for discussing Lorentz invariant relativistic quantum field theories. And in those theories, it's often more standard to use energy rather than distance in order to indicate scale. So here the energy will be denoted by E, and there will be a high energy cutoff lambda, which is inversely related to the lattice cutoff that we were using in position space in the beginning of the talk. But I will kind of be smoothly switching back and forth between the energy and the distance way of talking about things. Right. So now, the name renormalization group is essentially historical, and I will not explain where that comes from, but this is what it means. And the dynamics of a quantum field theory traces a flow, so-called renormalization group flow, from the ultraviolet or short distances to the infrared at long distances. So this is a cartoon picture of a renormalization group flow. You start at high energies at the cutoff scale, and at that scale the system might look like a lattice or some other discrete system that we started with, and then you follow the dynamics, you know, kind of you organize the dynamics by scale, and you trace it from short to long distances. And once you arrive at very long distances, at approximately zero energy, only massless or gapless excitations survive. And all the massive gap excitations that were present at intermediate energies or at very high energies do not affect the long distance dynamics. And this is an important phenomenon known as decoupling. And the main point of decoupling is that at the end of the day, there are fewer relevant physical degrees of freedom in the deep IR than you started out with in the UV. Now, the degrees of freedom with zero energy have an interesting emergence symmetry, which is scale invariance, roughly speaking, because zero doesn't have any units. That's cutting it a bit short. This emergent scale invariance near zero energy is associated with what's called the renormalization group fixed point, because if you follow this flow, then once you approach zero energy, you know, you kind of stay there forever. And under favorable conditions, this emergent scale symmetry is further enhanced to what's known as the full conformal group, or the full conformal symmetry, which is the group SOD, 2. And Joel Polsinski here has clarified in various important ways when this enhancement from scale invariance to conformal symmetry actually happens. And what that means is that the IR fixed point is not only scale invariant, but in a full-fledged conformal field theory. And just a brief comment that will not play a huge role later in the talk is that, you know, here I've emphasized everywhere the lattice cutoff, the underlying short distance cutoff, but it is actually sometimes possible to take that cutoff to infinity and I get a continuum theory at all scales, but this requires a second fixed point of the renormalization group in the deep UV that controls the short distance behavior. So this was the first part of the talk, and let me summarize briefly what I've said so far. So the first message was that in quantum field theory, various intuitive ways of counting degrees of freedom always include some unwanted effects from very short distances near the cutoff or the lattice or whatever you used to define the theory in the first place. And very often they dominate this naive degree of freedom count, and they can even make it infinite. And so all of this basically just means that these way of thinking about degrees of freedom counting were not useful ways. Perhaps intuitive, but not useful. The second thing that we learned from the renormalization group is that we should focus on the effective low energy or long distance degrees of freedom that are important at very long macroscopic distances. And the third statement in that context was that the effective number of physically relevant degree of freedom, whatever that means, should in some sense decrease along renormalization group flows from short to long distances. So this last statement is a little bit imprecise. It's not a very sharp statement. It's kind of a physical principle or a piece of intuition. And we will soon make it more precise in the second part of the talk. OK, so part two is how to count degrees of freedom in quantum field theory. That was really what I promised you in the title. And as I said, the first part was mainly, among other things, supposed to convince you that this is not a totally obvious thing to do. And what I'll try to do in the second part is give you a brief sense of how one can do better. And this will actually rather quickly take us into kind of current research territory. And it'll also give me an opportunity to mention a few things that I've worked on. Okay, so let me introduce the notion of a C function. So the idea is that we would like to make our whole discussion about counting degrees of freedom more precise by introducing some kind of counting function. So let me call this counting function, a C function. Okay, second try. There we go. So C here stands for counting. That's not the historical origin of the name C, but I think it's a better reason for calling it a C function. And based on the sort of very general lessons that we learned in part one, we might ask what properties should a useful C function have? What are the kind of properties we expect it to have? Just sort of on very general grounds before we get into the details. So the primary property it should have is it should be well-defined. It should be a number and it should be finite. It should avoid this UV catastrophe type of problem that we encountered in the naive setting. It should be dimensionless, because otherwise it's not a number. You can rescale it and make it anything you want. And you might think that because it's supposed to count something, it should also be quantized in some sense. That's what certainly the naive analogy with counting would suggest. But in fact, it turns out that that's a bit too strong. It's in fact too strong to demand that the C function should be quantized. So we will not demand that. And finally, we would like it to be positive, at least in unitary theories, right? I'm always assuming unitarity throughout the talk, any useful notion of counting degrees of freedom should mean that, you know, you can only add to that count, you can't take away from it. It shouldn't be stuff that counts negatively. Now, the whole, let me just make one comment here, right? So C should be positive, but it might be zero. And I'll briefly comment on theories that have very few or almost no degrees of freedom, but are not completely trivial, where C is zero, but they're not the empty theory. Now, from the whole randomization group discussion, we've also learned that C is not a number. It's not one number. It's actually a function that depends on the length scale at which you examine the system. Right? We've seen that the number of degrees of freedom should vary as you go from short to long distances. So we expect that C is a function of length scale L, and that the derivative with respect to L, as you go from short to long distances, is negative. This means that C is decreasing as you scale towards the infrared. Okay? And as a consequence of this statement, just by integrating it between the UV and the IR fixed point, you get this weaker inequality, which says that C of the UV theory should be strictly bigger than C of the IR theory if you have a non-trivial randomization group flow. Okay? And statements like this one in bullet point 2 or this one in bullet point 3 are often called C theorems. This terminology is very loose. In particular, the word C theorem is used even when there is no actual proof of the conjectured statement. So this is unfortunate, but it's useful to bear it in mind. And what these inequalities are supposed to do is quantify the intuitive notion that the number of degrees of freedom decreases towards the IR, that the heavy degrees of freedom decouple. So this is supposed to be a precise version of that. Okay, so let me discuss the C theorem in two dimensions. In two space-time dimensions, Sasha Zamolodchikov was the first person to construct an example of a C function. And what he did is he used two-point correlation functions of the stress-energy tensor T mu nu. And so in particular, use the energy density, which is just the 0, 0 time component of the stress tensor. And so he looked at the two-point function of the energy density, and there were some correction terms that he had to add for technical reasons, which involve other components of T. I will kind of sweep these under the rug, mostly focus on this one. The energy density in two space-time dimensions has units of 1 over length squared. So this thing has units of 1 over length to the fourth. So if you multiply it by L to the fourth, you get a nice dimensionless object. And this is the candidate C function that he wrote down after including these corrections. And he proved that the first derivative of this candidate C function is indeed negative using only very, very general principles of quantum field theory, like, for example, energy conservation, which in this context is just the statement that the stress tensor is conserved, the conserved current associated with translations and rotations. He used Lorentz invariance, and he crucially used unitarity. So this is a very general fact about 2D theories that follows very simply from very general principles. One thing you can see from this equation is that if C happens to be zero, then this two-point function of the energy density is zero. And a two-point function of some operator is only zero if the operator itself is zero. That's something that follows from unitarity, roughly speaking, because a two-point function is like a norm squared. So what this shows is that the C function is always non-negative, and it can only be zero if the energy density itself is the zero operator. And that is only possible in theories that are topological, that don't have any local degrees of freedom that carry energy density, but that might have some kind of global degrees of freedom that extend over all of space-time. Good. Now, just on a kind of intuitive note, the fact that the stress tensor somehow plays a role in constructing a C function that counts degrees of freedom is not so surprising, since essentially all local degrees of freedom are expected to carry some type of energy. Okay, so what I would like to do in the next two slides is give two kind of related or alternative interpretations of the C function that Zamolodikov constructed, and those two alternative interpretations will be useful for us going forward and discussing what one should do in other space-time dimensions. So the first thing that I would like to do is to explain the relation of the C function to the trace anomaly. So at conformal fixed points, scale invariance implies that the C function on the previous slide, it cannot depend on L. It's actually just a constant number. And it turns out to be related or proportional to the so-called Virasoro central charge. And I won't explain in detail what that is, but it's a standard quantity in two-dimensional conformal field theory. And in fact, this is the historical origin of the name C function, because it started its life as the Virasoro central charge, which happens to be conventionally called C. And this quantity determines many, many other useful physical quantities in the CFT. For example, the Virasoro central charge also determines the thermal free energy of a CFT. And you might think, since we are now on the subject, that the thermal free energy is also a pretty good intuitive candidate for counting degrees of freedom in a quantum field theory. That's something you might have tried. And indeed, you see in two dimensions, it agrees with this other Virasoro central charge definition. But it turns out that in higher dimensions, this kind of intuition breaks down. And in fact, there are known examples, carefully studied examples in more than two space-time dimensions, where the thermal free energy is not an acceptable C function. That is to say, it doesn't satisfy all of the axioms or general properties that I listed in a couple of slides ago. So even though it's intuitive and perhaps more refined than this very naive degree of freedom counting that I introduced in the beginning of the talk, it's still not an acceptable C function. Which goes to show you that even though we have a very intuitive idea of what degrees of freedom means, it's not so easy to come up with an actual C function. Now, in this context, it's interesting to think about the response of the stress tensor to its classical source. This was a concept that I introduced a little bit in part one. If you have a quantum field or an operator, one way to probe it is to turn on a classical source that couples to it. And the appropriate classical source that couples to the stress tensor is, unsurprisingly, a metric. That's how it works in general relativity, where the metric is dynamical. Here, the metric is not dynamical. It's just a background field. It's a classical source that we tune, say, in the lab, to study the response of the stress tensor. And this might seem a bit academic, because it's not clear what you might mean by tuning the metric in the lab. But if you have an actual material, you can subject it to various stresses and shears and so forth and simulate the effects of a background metric. So this is practically doable. And the response of the stress tensor to the metric is very complicated. It encodes lots and lots of information about the theory, including all the correlation functions of the stress tensor. There's kind of one part of it that's very simple and very interesting, and that's the response function of the trace of the stress tensor. Right? And that turns out to have an incredibly simple form. So the response function of the trace is just proportional to the Virasoro central charge times the Ricci curvature, the Ricci scalar of the background metric. And remember that we're in 2D, so Ricci scalar is the only independent curvature invariant. And so this is a non-zero expectation value, and that's surprising because we're discussing a conformal field theory, and conformal invariants, one way of encoding conformal invariants is saying that the stress tensor should be traceless. I won't explain that in too much detail, but this is one of the many equivalent ways of stating what you might mean by conformal invariants. And here we have a situation where the stress tensor is zero in flat space, right? If you go back to a flat metric, the right-hand side vanishes. But it is, in fact, non-zero in a general curve background. And that is a situation where you have a symmetry of a flat space quantum field theory, namely conformal symmetry, that is broken by the turning on the corresponding source. And that's the sort of hallmark of what's called an anomaly in quantum field theory. Okay? Conformal symmetry is broken in curved space, even though it's present in flat space. And I will not explain in detail how anomalies work either, except to say that they're very, very common in quantum field theory, and their study is a rich and interesting subject. And roughly speaking, the way that one can view an anomaly is that it's some effect that arises from the fact that back in the deep back of our minds, we defined the theory using a short distance cutoff. And we thought that most of that cutoff disappeared when we went to the continuum limit, but the anomaly is a remnant that doesn't completely decouple. So it's a very interesting effect. So the lesson from this slide is that the Virasoro central charge, which was the C function in a 2D CFT, is also the same as this coefficient that appears in the trace anomaly. That's interpretation number one. Interpretation number two is the relation to vacuum entanglement. So let me remind you in one sentence how the very basic notions of entanglement work. If you start with some pure state, psi, in a factorized Hilbert space of this form that factorizes into two tensor factors, H sub A and H sub B, that you can think of as corresponding to different subsystems of the full quantum system, then you can construct what's called the reduced density matrix of the state psi, where you, you take the outer product of psi with itself, and then you trace over the sub-Hilbert space H sub A. And this reduced density matrix characterizes the quantum mechanical entanglement between the subsystems A and B in the state psi. So rho is a very useful quantity. And the von Neumann entropy, the standard von Neumann entropy of rho, which is minus trace rho log rho, is what's called the entanglement entropy of this partition in this state. So this is a useful measure of quantum entanglement. And let's see how this works out in two-dimensional conformal field theory. So in two-dimensional conformal field theory, we can take psi to just be the vacuum state of the quantum field theory. That's a very natural state that's always around. And we are just studying the Hilbert space on a, you know, on a line in flat space. And then we're going to partition the Hilbert space into two by cutting the line into two subregions. There will be subregion A, which is an interval of length L, and then there will be B, which is just the complement of A. And then you can ask, in that context, what is the entanglement entropy of the conformal field theory in the vacuum state once you do this partition of the system? And this was answered a long time ago by Frank Wilczek and two of his students. And this is the answer. You get an entanglement which is, again, proportional to the Virasoro central charge times a logarithm of the length of the interval. And there's a lambda here, which is a UV cutoff, which has all sorts of interesting interpretations. But for the purposes of what I'm saying now, all that really matters is that the same Virasoro central charge shows up that we've already encountered on the previous two slides. And if you want to go beyond conformal field theories and study non-trivial renormalization group flows, then it turns out that this quantity, the interval entanglement entropy, is a very useful quantity because it actually defines another C function, a new type of C function, which is different from the one that Zamolodnikov constructed. And you can use that C function to give a new and different proof of the two-dimensional C theorem, which was done by Cassini and Huerta about 10 years ago. So. Maybe a little more. And so the second slogan is that the number of degrees of freedom, at least in two dimensions, is encoded in vacuum entanglement. It's encoded in the trace anomaly, and it's encoded in vacuum entanglement. Okay, so we understand a little bit what's going on in two dimensions, and now we can see what happens in other space-time dimensions, in particular higher space-time dimensions. And there the situation is sort of a little bit different in even and odd dimensions. It turns out that in all even space-time dimensions, there is always a trace anomaly. There are always trace anomalies. So you can always study the gravitational response of the stress tensor, in particular of the trace of the stress tensor, to a background metric G. And you will always find on the right-hand side some type of dimensionless coefficient, let's call it little a, times a curvature invariant called the Euler density. The Euler density is some type of curvature invariant that's made up of various contractions of Riemann tensors. And in d dimensions, it's always made up of contractions of d over 2 Riemann tensors. And remember that d is even. So it goes like Riemann squared in 4 dimensions, Riemann cubed in 6 dimensions, and so forth. And the ellipsis here on the right-hand side includes all sorts of other trace anomalies that are generically present, but that I won't discuss in detail. And just to see how this fits with the two-dimensional story, in two dimensions, remember that the Euler density was just the Ricci scalar, and what we call A here was just the Virasoro central charge there. And on the basis of this analogy and a few other pieces of evidence, John Carty, almost 30 years ago, when he was a professor here, conjectured that this number, the A anomaly, actually satisfies a C theorem in all even dimensions. So he conjectured that the A of the UV theory should always be bigger than the A of the infrared theory. And in this context, this conjecture is known as an A theorem, or the A theorem. And this proved to be a very fruitful conjecture that stimulated a lot of activity. But it took a very long time to prove, even in four dimensions, which is the first case above two where this conjecture applies. It was proven by Komorgotsky and Schwimmer quite recently. And in six or more dimensions, it's actually an open problem. And if you are wondering why I'm talking about quantum field theory in six dimensions, you should. And I will say a few words about that at the end of the talk. By the way, I should also say that among the axioms we had was the requirement that the C function should be positive. And so if this conjecture is to hold water, we also expect that the A anomaly should be positive in all even dimensions. And it turns out that's a known fact in four dimensions. It was proven by these gentlemen. But it's actually also an unproven and open problem in six or higher dimensions. Now, that was the even dimensional case. In odd dimensions, the situation is very different because there are, in fact, no trace anomalies. So we can't use this analogy with trace anomalies to even get off the ground. But since we also had a different interpretation in terms of vacuum entanglement, we can try to build on that. And even though I have absolutely no time to explain how that works, that is actually a very, very successful and fruitful point of view. For example, in three space-time dimensions, again, Cassini and Huerta were able to use vacuum entanglement across a disk-shaped region to construct a viable C function and give a proof of a C theorem there. And even though that proof has kind of still, has gone through various iterations of digestions, it seems to hold up and really be correct in a very, very useful way of thinking about C theorems in general. So that's the rough overview. Now, we've talked about C theorems, we've talked about counting degrees of freedom, and throughout the talk I've kind of tried to emphasize the conceptual importance of counting degrees of freedom and C functions for quantum field theory, but we might ask if they're good for anything, kind of more concretely. So the answer is yes, and I don't have time to do justice to that, but I would like to just sort of throw out a few of the various things you might be able to do with a useful C function. So the first thing is that they unsurprisingly constrain randomization group flows, right? The C theorem says that allowed randomization group flows are not completely arbitrary. They have to satisfy this constraint that C is bigger in the UV than in the IR. So that means that, for example, if you have a UV theory and you have a guess for what it does in the infrared, you have to make sure that guess passes even the rough checks that the C-theorem imposes. So let me give you a very vague, simple example of how you might use that. Let's say you have a gauge theory in four dimensions, a little bit like QCD, with some matter content, a bunch of fermions, maybe in different representations. Let's say you suspect that the theory breaks chiral symmetry in the infrared and there are a bunch of Goldstone bosons. The Goldstone theorem tells you that there are as many Goldstone bosons as broken symmetry, so you have a guess for how many Goldstone bosons there are. If it turns out that your guess involves a huge number of Goldstone bosons, they'll contribute a lot to the infrared C function. And then if you compare that to the ultraviolet value of the C function, you might find that you have too many Goldstone bosons. So that means that this proposed symmetry breaking pattern is actually not possible. It's inconsistent with the C theorem. And you can use this kind of logic to rule out all sorts of candidate IR phases for given ultraviolet theories. In three dimensions, you can put limits on the size of topological sectors and so forth. Now, a second thing that you can do with C functions is that if you're lucky, there are circumstances in which they control the actual density of states of the quantum field theory, at least in some regime. And a classic example of that is what's called Cardy's formula in two-dimensional CFTs, where the high-energy density of state is completely determined by the Virasoro central charge. And there are some higher-dimensional analogs of that, although they're pretty scarce. And finally, I'm going to come back to this vague comment that made about black holes and how you might use to degree of freedom counting in quantum field theory to understand something about them. And the comment here is that at least if you're interested in the entropy of certain classes of black holes, it turns out that you can explain that or calculate it by counting degrees of freedom in a different but related problem, which is actually a quantum field theory. So you would like to calculate the entropy of some black hole and you find an associated quantum field theory problem where you count degrees of freedom and the answer to that question turns out to be the entropy of the original black hole you started with. Now that sounds like a pretty dramatic situation, but they're very concrete constructions in string theory where you can find such a associated quantum field theory. And more generically, this is kind of quite natural in the context of holography, which is usually known as the ADS-CFT correspondence. We have a very generic correspondence between gravitational theories and different but precisely associated quantum field theories. So at least for the purposes of some questions, counting degrees of freedom in quantum field theory can teach you something about black holes. Now, everything that I've said has been quite general, and I haven't gone into the actual details of how one analyzes C functions and how one tests whether they're really C functions and do all the things that we think they are. They do. Oops. But the basic problem is that analyzing candidate C functions in specific examples is quite challenging, especially if the examples are interacting theories. As Gary mentioned in the beginning, interacting quantum field theories are still a major challenge to us in many ways. And supersymmetric quantum field theories have played sort of an important role in the development of this whole subject of C functions because they provide a rich zoo of examples that can be analyzed in great detail. Okay? And I'll say a few words about why that is in just a second, but let me just make two comments for the more technical audience. There are two developments in supersymmetry that go under the name of A maximization and F maximization, which you can roughly speaking think of as supersymmetric versions of C theorems, at least in four and three dimensions. And these were kind of independent developments in supersymmetry over the last 10-15 years that independently established supersymmetric C theorems in both cases actually predated the understanding of the corresponding non-supersymmetric C theorem. So they kind of provided major evidence that the objects that people were discussing and the conjectures that people had made actually made sense and were on the right track. And just one sentence about why supersymmetry helps. I mean, you've almost certainly heard of supersymmetry as a symmetry that relates bosons and fermions and leads to dramatic cancellations in many computations. For example, famously, the quadratic divergence of the Higgs mass in the standard model. That's why it's an attractive candidate for physics beyond the standard model, because it can try to resolve the so-called hierarchy or fine-tuning problem that is associated with this divergence. But the same type of cancellations that make that possible are also responsible for the additional theoretical control that you enjoy if you study these theories. Because roughly speaking, you know, there's a lot of cancellations going on, and otherwise very complicated computation can boil down to a much simpler subproblem. So this is the very, very rough picture of why supersymmetry helps, even if you're just interested in general quantum field theory questions. Okay. Now, we've discussed the C theorem in two dimensions. I've said what the various candidates or conjectures are in higher dimensions. And I also said that that some cases have been proven, namely a four-dimensional case. So for example, the four-dimensional A theorem has been proven. And I would like to give you a very, very intuitive flavor of what the proof looks like. So we said that in even dimensions in general, we should be looking at the A-type Weyl anomaly or trace anomaly that is associated with the trace of the stress tensor in an external gravitational field. But we've also said that studying an operator in the presence of its corresponding source is the same as studying correlation functions of that operator without the source. So that means that the A anomaly sits somewhere in the correlation functions of the stress tensor. And these are, in general, very complicated. But it turns out that in very special limits, they look like scattering amplitudes of a massless scalar particle that, for various historical reasons, is called the dilaton. So this is some scalar field phi of x. And so the claim is that by studying scattering of that scalar particle, you can actually learn something about the non-trivial and complicated correlation functions of the stress tensor. And because those know about the A anomaly, it turns out that if you study the right scattering amplitudes, you actually learn something about the quantity delta A, which is this change in the A anomaly as you go from the UV to the infrared. So this is the quantity that you need to prove is positive in order to establish an A theorem. And the claim is that this is a quantity that shows up in some type of special scattering amplitudes of this dilaton particle. So at this point, we're just doing scattering of massless particles. We know what we're doing. And here I've drawn cartoons that, roughly speaking, represent the situation in two space-time dimensions and in four space-time dimensions. In two space-time dimensions, recall that the C function was associated with a two-point function of the stress tensor. And we said that two-point functions have to do with propagation, not with scattering. So if you look at the propagation of the dilaton from point X to point Y, you get some type of probability amplitude that turns out to be proportional to delta A, which we said in two dimensions was just the change in the Virasoro central charge. And again, we've already encountered this. Two-point functions in unitary theories are naturally positive because they have a probability interpretation as a norm squared. So just that by the virtue of the fact that this two-point function is proportional to delta A or delta C, you get a different proof of Zamolodchikov's C theorem that the C function in 2D decreases under RG flow. So this was just more or less free propagation. In four dimensions, the story is a little more interesting because the correct scattering amplitude that you need to look at in order to extract delta A is a four-point function of dilatons. So this is now a four-point scattering amplitude of these four scalar particles. So you send them all in, and then you know something happens in the middle. They interact. And the claim is that this whole amplitude is proportional to delta A. And it turns out that there's a kind of subtle and interesting positivity associated with this kind of four-point amplitude in four dimensions that essentially comes from the optical theorem. So in special limits, if you fine-tune the kinematics of these dilatons and you pick their momenta just right, you actually can prove that this four-point amplitude has to be positive, roughly speaking, because of the optical theorem. And the claim is that because the amplitude is proportional to delta A, that establishes the 4DA theorem. So 2D C theorem or A theorem was a two-point function. 4D A theorem was a four-point function. Now we keep going. What happens in 6D? Well, first we need to go back to the elephant in the room and discuss why the hell we should be discussing quantum field theory in more than four space-time dimensions. I have alluded to this point at various points during the talk. And for example, we might ask whether such theories even exist and why should we discuss them. As far as the first point is concerned, it's a kind of long-standing standard lore that interacting UV-complete quantum field theories do not exist in more than four space-time dimensions. So, you know, when you study elementary quantum field theory or Landau's theory of statistical phase transitions, you learn that four is the upper critical dimension for interacting field theories. And an intuitive way of understanding this that kind of is in the spirit of part one of the talk is that if you try to make an interacting continuum theory by starting with a lattice model and adding all sorts of interactions to that lattice model, then as you take the continuum limit, as you take the lattice spacing to zero, all the interactions that you put in by hand will actually wash out, and you'll end up with a non-interacting free theory. So it's very hard to make interacting quantum field theories in more than four dimensions. Now, it turns out that kind of constructions in non-perturbative string theory, starting in the mid-90s, very surprisingly provided many examples of precisely such theories that we thought couldn't exist in five and six dimensions. And because they arise as the decoupling limits of string theory, they all turn out to be supersymmetric theories. So we have, you know, that handle on them. But in many, many ways, they're difficult to describe directly. You can either try to study them in the full string theory, but we don't have a good handle of them as quantum field theories, and trying to say something useful about them using field theoretic techniques is an active frontier in the subject, and just the fact that these theories are so difficult to analyze should be reason enough to study them, because, you know, if our goal in life is to understand more about quantum field theory, then we should try to push you know, our abilities to the point where they break down. And in the spirit of this talk, you know, if we are given a new and interesting class of quantum field theories, we should try to study RG flows between them and look for C theorems. So let's ask about the A theorem in six dimensions. And we already said two dilatons, four dilatons. Now in six dimensions, there will be six dilatons. So proving an A theorem in six dimensions would amount to showing that a very particular six dilaton amplitude of this form, which is proportional to delta A in six dimensions, has to be positive. And this is now an even more complicated amplitude than we had before. There's six external particles. We send them all in. Something complicated happens in the middle that I'm not trying to explain to you, represented by this star. And in general, nobody has succeeded in coming up with an argument that shows that the six dilaton amplitude is always positive. So proving the A theorem in six dimensions is an interesting open problem. And I'm sure that we would learn something quite general and interesting about quantum field theory if we could prove such a positivity statement. Now, it turns out that supersymmetry helps a lot, because what supersymmetry tells you in these theories is that this six-point amplitude is actually somewhat special. It factorizes into two halves. So roughly speaking, there's a three-point amplitude here, then there's some type of intermediate particle propagating through here, and then there are three points over here. And this six-point amplitude is, roughly speaking, the square, the norm squared of these two three-point amplitudes. The limit that you have to take in order to get delta A is such that the intermediate propagating particle basically doesn't play an important role, and the amplitude factorizes, and you just get a square of the two sides. So because the six-point amplitude has this special factorized form in supersymmetric theories, the fact that delta A is positive is trivial, because it's a perfect square. And even though it only applies to supersymmetric theories, just like in lower dimensions, this is strong evidence and strong motivation for the fact that it's probably true more generally, and we should keep looking. So this is pretty much what I wanted to say. Just the three or four main points for emphasis. So we said that in quantum field theory, short distance effects render overly simple or naive ways of counting degrees of freedom useless. And C functions are useful tools for more precisely quantifying the number of degrees of freedom in those theories. And they may concise the intuition that this number should degrees under renormalization group flows from the UV to the IR. And we've also reviewed a little bit how the known C functions that have been constructed are related to vacuum entanglement, and at least in even dimensions, to A-type trace anomalies. I also explained a little bit how dilaton scattering can be used to establish the A-theorem in four dimensions, and at least its supersymmetric cousin in six dimensions. So I'll stop here, and thank you.
So the whole talk is about counting degrees of freedom, right? And so we like these CNA functions because they fit our intuition about the degrees of freedom decreasing as you go along the flow. But if we wanted to consider the whole space of quantum field theories, let's say, then we would also want to compare, you know, we might have some intuition about two sort of different flows of unique UV fixed points. And, you know, say, you know, okay, does C then fit our intuition that, you know, this theory with this UV fixed point, you know, we might expect to have more degrees of freedom than this other one. Has there been work in sort of comparing field theories with along different flows?
Right, but are you imagining that these field theories that at some point flow to each other or
maybe
don't?
Not. Maybe they're very far away from each other.
Well, it's true that you could use, I mean, even if field theories don't somehow flow into each other, you can try to organize the entire list. If you make a list of all field theories, you could try to order them according to C.
Right.
And you might ask if that teaches you something.
Right, does that fit your intuition, I guess?
You know, there's some general picture that I think various people have tried to make precise, that it is indeed useful to think about the whole landscape of field theories this way. It's a little bit hard to make precise what you mean by the space of all field theories if you can't actually flow from one another. But I think one of the main messages of this talk is it's always a good idea to organize everything by scale and everything by how many degrees of freedom it has. And the two are, of course, very much related.
So for a given quantum field theory, you know, is there always like only one C function I can build?
No, absolutely. That's a very good question. Thank you. So even in two dimensions, the kind of best understood case, there are multiple C functions. They're not unique. They're both perfectly fine. Now, the requirements that I sort of laid out always mean that at the fixed points, the conformal fixed points, any definition has to agree.
Okay.
But in between, they could look very different. You know, one could go like this, and the other one could go like this. As long as they're both monotonic, that's perfectly fine. And you know, I give two examples, the one constructed using energy correlators by Zamolodnikov and the one using entanglement. And indeed, if you plot them, even in very simple examples, they look completely different.
Okay, but I mean, what I'm asking is, like, is it possible to kind of, you know, find the relationship between these two that tells me that actually they are the same thing? Or are they intrinsically different?
They're literally different. I mean, you plot them, they're not the same function, and there's no known simple relation between the two. You might ask whether there should be a preferred one, whether one is better than the others.
Right.
And there's a sense in which Zamolodnikov's is better because it not only, you know, has the nice behavior at the endpoints that you demanded, but it has the property that its first derivative at the endpoints vanishes. So it kind of, you know, looks more like this, and it satisfies something called a gradient flow equation, which is what we like to be true for C functions in general. You know, it has a few additional good properties that the other one doesn't, but the other one is perfectly fine.
Okay, well, let's thank Thomas again.